We're going to talk a little bit about land issues in America this morning. And as I began to think about what I might possibly say this morning, I was reminded of the story of the fellow whose only real claim to fame in life was that he had survived the Johnstown flood in Pennsylvania, the famous Johnstown flood. And because that was his really only claim to fame, he made the most of it. In fact, he couldn't walk up to anybody without saying, I survived the Johnstown flood, and then going on to explain and tell about his experience. And he did this to the point where he really became a pest to his friends, and they'd cross the street so that they wouldn't have to meet him on the street, because that's all they wanted to talk about was the Johnstown flood. And finally, like all of us, the man died and went to heaven. And he got to the pearly gates, and he was meeting St. Peter for the entrance ceremonies. And he said to St. Peter, he said, "St. Peter, you know, I survived the Johnstown flood." And St. Peter said, "Yes, I know that." And he said, "That's all here in this book." And the man said, "You know, I just love to tell about my experience." He said, "I used to talk to Rotary clubs and Lions clubs and address all sorts of church groups about this." He said, "Is there any chance that I might be able to get a group here in heaven together and we could talk about it, share my experience?" And St. Peter said, "Well, yeah, that's possible." He said, every Tuesday night we have a kind of a get-together here in heaven. And he said, "I'm sure we can arrange to put you on the program. However," he said, "you need to remember when you're up there talking to these folks that Noah is in the audience." And I feel kind of that way with talking about land issues in America, because first of all, they're so diverse. America is a big country, of course, and the issues are a bit different from one section to another. And I think there are probably lots of folks here who know as much or more about the issues than I do. So I don't pose to be some kind of an expert on land issues, but I do think that there are some biblical and some theological affirmations that we can make about the land as Christian people. And I think there are probably some basic concerns that we share, and so I want this morning just to give voice to some of those affirmations and some of those concerns. I think the first thing that we affirm as Christian people about the land is that the land is a gift. The Old Testament speaks over and over again of the earth as belonging to God. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. But God entrusts this gift of land to his people. Listen how often this theme is repeated in the first four verses of the 26th chapter of Deuteronomy. "When you come into the land which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance, and have taken possession of it and live in it, you shall take some of the first fruit of the ground which you harvest from your land that the Lord your God gives you, and you shall put it in a basket, and you shall go to the place which the Lord your God will choose to make his name to dwell there. And you shall go to the priest who is in office at that time and say to him, 'I desire this day, I declare this day to the Lord your God that I have come into the land which the Lord swore to our fathers to give us.' Then the priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down before the altar of the Lord your God." Again and again, this theme that the land is something that has been given to us by God. So the first thing we have to say about the land is that it is a gift that's been given to us by God. And the products of the land are likewise then gifts of God. Now we symbolize that in some ways. We use bread and wine in our worship to communicate what God has done for us in Christ. But the bread and wine also remind us that these come to us by God's blessing. God once promised Noah, quote, "While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease." That's true. We also then have enjoyed the benefits of these great rhythms in our lifetime and in our land. So for us too, the land has been a gift, first of all, and the products of the land have been a blessing. In this country, I think we've been especially blessed by God in terms of the richness of the land and its produce. And the question then becomes, how can we show our grateful response? How can this blessing that we have be used in such a way that it becomes a blessing for others? The New Testament reminds us that full barns are no assurance of the abundant life. But the hard question becomes one of distribution. How can we share what's in those barns so that there is plenty for everyone? The land is a gift of God. But the scriptures are also clear that we are not free to do whatever we want to with that gift. The land is to be used for the purpose which God intends. In fact, the land is fulfilled and will continue to be productive only so long as God's will for the land is practiced. So the land is not only a gift, the land is also given to us as a task. First a gift, then a task. In the first chapter of Genesis, we read that God said to the first humans, "Fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." What does that mean, that we should have dominion over the earth? Some have understood this in terms of license or exploitation. In his Bible study on the land, Jim Lindberg, who teaches Old Testament at Luther Northwestern Seminary, quotes a book entitled Design with Nature by Ian McHarg, in which the author writes about this first chapter in Genesis, quote, "If one seeks license for those who would increase radioactivity, create canals and harbors with atomic bombs, employ poisons without constraint, or give consent to the bulldozer mentality, there could be no better injunction than this text," unquote. Well, I wonder, what does that word dominion really mean? Lindberg reminds us that the word that's used belongs to the language of kingship. It's the word that is used to describe the rule of a king over his subjects. And the point of Genesis is that we are to relate to the rest of creation the way a king would relate to his subjects. And the Old Testament was quite clear about what was expected of a king. He was to judge the people with righteousness. He was to have special concern for the weak, the powerless, the helpless. For a king to have dominion did not mean that he had license to exploit the people over whom he ruled, like some selfish dictator. Rather, to have dominion over them was to have the care of his subjects and to give special attention to the weak and to the helpless. Well, what is the task then that's ours in relation to the land which has been entrusted to us? How is this dominion, this care of the land, to translate into questions of farming practice like crop rotation or the use of chemical fertilizers? Bible doesn't give any specific answers to those questions. But it does tell us that we must exercise responsible care, like a good king who takes care for those over whom he rules. In the second creation account, in Genesis 2, we're told that after God created man, quote, "The Lord took the man and put him in the garden to till it and keep it." The two words, till and keep, summarize, in some sense, the tasks of the farmer. to till the ground was the first task that God gave to human beings. This gives dignity to the work of the farmer. But we're also called by God to keep the land. This means that conservation is as much a part of God's purpose as tilling. Same truth was expressed very well in a speech by Chief Seattle in 1854, when he concluded a treaty with the U.S. government for some land, and this is what he said. "So if we sell you our land, love it as we have loved it. Care for it as we've cared for it. Hold in your mind the memory of the land as it is when you take it. And with all your strength, with all your mind, with all your heart, preserve it for your children. And love it as God loves us all." We've been entrusted then with the task of tilling and keeping the land. Lindbergh makes this comment in connection with this. He says, "Now at the end of the 20th century, we see that we've done quite well at tilling. We've developed agricultural technology, which is the envy of the whole world. We've learned how to increase productivity, to fertilize, to maximize the use of every square foot of farmland. But we need to listen carefully to that call to keep the earth. The model for such keeping is the kind of care which the Lord Himself gives to His people. It would appear that the urgent task for our time is to expend as much creative energy in learning to keep the earth as earlier generations have expended in learning to till it." Unquote. Land is a gift. Land is a task. The Old Testament also suggests that the land is a temptation. The land is a temptation because when the land yields its bounty, then the people are tempted to regard this as simply the fruit of their own labor and to forget their dependence upon God. Listen to the words of Deuteronomy again, this time in the 8th chapter, some selected verses beginning at verse 7. Should have brought my glasses along for this one. "For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks and water, of fountains and springs, flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey. A land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper. And you shall eat and be full, and you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land that He has given you. Take heed, lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping His commandments and His ordinances and His statutes, which I command you this day. Lest when you have eaten and are full, and have built goodly houses and live in them, and your herds and flocks multiply, and your silver and gold is multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart be lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." Again, beginning at verse 17. "Beware lest you say in your heart, 'My power and the might of my hand has gotten me this wealth.' You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is He who gives you power to get wealth, that He may confirm His covenant, which He swore to your fathers as at this day. And if you forget the Lord your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I solemnly warn you this day that you shall surely perish." The land is given as a base for human community, lived under God. But the temptation The writer says, especially in good times, is to forget God. The temptation is to rely upon our own achievement. The temptation is to covet, to succumb to greed. The temptation is to want more than a gift. To forget that the blessing comes from God can mean an insatiable appetite which grasps for more and more and more, but is never satisfied. And then human community, as God intended, is disrupted. Well, now we know, of course, that we don't any longer live in the Garden of Eden. And sin has left its mark on the land and issues surrounding the land, as well as on every other area of human endeavor. But no age and no enterprise is ever without its problems. But there are three basic concerns in relation to the land that I think are critical today. They are, first of all, concentration. Concentration of land ownership. Secondly, conservation. Conservation of the land. And thirdly, the issue of community, the preservation of community or way of life on the land. The first issue then, as I said, I think, is the issue of concentration of land ownership. Richard Prigge, in a Lutheran Standard article several years ago, said that the number of people engaged in farming in the United States has declined by 70% since 1950. The number of farms has fallen from a peak of nearly 7 million to nearly 2 million today, of which about one-fifth of those produce nearly 80% of the nation's food and fiber. Moreover, Prigge points out what I think is clear to all of us, namely that an increasingly capital-intensive agriculture has made entry into farming by young persons virtually impossible. In 1978, the average investment in a modest-sized farm ranged from $302,000 for fruit and nut farms to $700,000 for livestock ranches. And public policies have generally tended to encourage this trend toward greater and greater concentration of land ownership. A report issued by the Congressional Budget Office in 1978 said that, quote, public policies now in place ensure a continuation of the current trend toward fewer, larger, more specialized farms, unquote. W. Fred Woods, who is a staff officer of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, said a couple of years ago, quote, although most public programs for agriculture are allegedly designed to help family farms, a major conclusion must inevitably be that federal policy on the whole has discouraged small farm operations. And since benefits are usually distributed in direct proportion to volume of or output, lead to greater concentration in farming, unquote. Situation of concentration of ownership is described again very well, I think, by Paul Johnson, who's the former editor of the Prairie Farmer magazine. He says, quote, during the last generation, we've seen more or less, during the last generation, we have been more or less committed to the inevitability of large machinery, high energy input, large fields, elimination of fence rows and windbreaks, specialization in crops or livestock, and heavy use of fertilizers and weed killers. This trend has been based on three premises. One, substituting technology for human labor is good. Two, technologies of scale go on forever. And three, problems of farming can be met indefinitely in increasing research and applied science, unquote. Then he goes on, since individual farmers trying to go it alone with the help of their local bankers and cooperatives have lost what was once their greatest strength, diversification. Their debts for machinery and annual outlay for fertilizer and chemicals nearly killed them. Added to the burden is interest on land purchased at unbelievably high rates. The effect of this whole process of concentration of ownership has meant fewer farmers and greater difficulty for a young person getting started in farming. It's meant expansion of acreage going hand in hand with specialization. In the part of Northeast Iowa, for instance, where I grew up, when I was growing up, it was diversified farming throughout that whole area. Now that countryside is just simply dotted with empty farmsteads, and there's nothing but corn as far as the eye can see. This loss of diversification has meant a certain loss of flexibility for many farmers. No longer is it possible to ride out low prices on one product by switching production to another or relying upon income from some of your other products. And the land is now pushed with chemical fertilizers and forcing marginal lands into production in ways that raise at least serious questions about about how long the land will be able to yield its bounty before it is depleted. This leads us to our second concern, the concern about conservation. Studies have shown that the smaller scale, more labor-intensive farming tends to be far more protective of the soil and less polluting of water. This is partly the result of the different effects of technology and partly a difference of attitude on the part of a small farmer. Ann Canton, who is a member of the ALC from Minnesota and who is currently our assistant commissioner of, no, she is our commissioner for agriculture in the state of Minnesota, puts the problem this way. She says, in the name of survival, we push land so hard that conservation practices are no longer possible. We lose 4 billion tons of topsoil each year, 2 bushels for each bushel of corn produced. Work and debt load pressure are more than some families can bear. Competition for pieces of land destroys friendships and communities, unquote. Again, Richard Prigge, who used to work on land issues for the Lutheran Council, has suggested the same kind of concern in relation to our stewardship of land and water resources. He says, quote, the largest share of America's tremendous agricultural productivity is due to our highly productive soil, plentiful water resources, and a moderate climate. In an increasingly interdependent world in which the U.S. needs the raw materials of developing nations as much as people in those countries need our food, we bear an important responsibility to protect and share our abundant agricultural resources rather than squander and exploit them. The type of land use, he continues, that results from control of large tracts of land tends to be highly energy intensive and as such constitutes a disproportionate drain on the world's energy resources. In the process, a heavy dependence upon chemical fertilizers and pesticides has meant an increasing deterioration of soil quality. By contrast, family farmers, according to a USDA report, have a genuine love of the land, a respect for it, and a desire to protect and preserve it. This attitude is not mercenary. It has roots that are almost religious. Well, it's not just a matter of mercenary indifference on the part of land, large agribusiness. The family farmer on the edge of survival is also pushed to use the land in ways that he or she knows is not good for the land in the long run. But survival in the short run seems to demand it. And that's the issue, I think. That's why they put that paragraph in this land statement that I'll pass out in a bit that reads like this. In current U.S. agriculture,
Economic realities may push some farmers into practices which are not consistent with good soil and water conservation. Because farm commodity prices have stayed chronically depressed in relation to farm production costs and the general cost of living, some farmers believe they are economically pressured into cutting corners on conservation practices. Our society must see the link between a national cheap food policy and the loss of topsoil and fresh water supplies. And non-farmers must be willing to accept higher food costs so that the food producer may have a fair reward, unquote. We have to somehow come to the place in this country where we begin to realize that the conservation of land is not just in the interest of the farmer. Conservation of land is really in everyone's long-term interest. Only then will we perhaps make it possible and profitable for farmers to practice the very best techniques that they know for soil and water conservation. A third concern, I said, about contemporary farming or agriculture has to do with the preservation of community or a certain way of life on the land. This concern is very much tied to the matter of concentration of ownership. It's been estimated, for instance, that one rural business fails for every six farms that disappear. And when farms are owned by absentee investors, then they don't need to be concerned about the maintenance of a rural community. They're not so concerned then about community facilities and services like health clinics or schools or churches. Studies have indicated that the quality of life is better preserved by family-sized farms than by larger scale farming. Comparative studies were conducted in two communities in California in the 1940s and then updated again in the late 1970s. And their conclusions were that the small farm community was supporting twice as many local businesses and that median family income and retail trade were both significantly higher in the small farm community, which also had more physical facilities, social services, schools, parks, playgrounds, and churches than the community based on large-scale mechanized agriculture. Similarly, a committee of the U.S. Catholic Conference in 1979 issued a statement on the family farm noting that the farm environment encourages the development of patience, self-reliance, a simplicity of outlook, and the particular bond that comes when father and mother and children join in earning their common bread. Now, I have to say, I think it's possible, of course, to romanticize all of that. I can personally remember very well the hard work, the drudgery, the worry that was part of life on the farm as I knew it when I grew up. But those positive qualities of farm life that they point to and which most of us identify with are also worth remembering and hanging on to. And the nation as a whole, I think, has a stake in maintaining something of that quality of life and that quality of community for as many people as possible. Well, where does the church fit into all of those concerns? What can we do as a church? What's our role? Certainly the church does not have the expertise or the power or the structure to provide solutions to the many problems which face rural America. But the church can provide a kind of perspective and can give some strength and hope to its people in the midst of their struggle with those issues. It can provide an arena where people can work together toward the solutions that will be in accord with God's will. I'd like to close my remarks this morning by quoting some words of Bishop Daryl Beekman of the Southwestern Minnesota District, probably the most rural district in the American Lutheran Church. And this is what he said. The rest of us must stand with farmers in recognizing that land is more than real estate, that grain is more than a commodity, that the neighbor is more than a competitor, and that farming is more than a business. Land is a trust from God, a space where faith can grow and grace be lived. Land has a sacred quality that isn't reducible to economics alone. The church also must speak publicly and boldly as an advocate of justice for the farmer. As farmers are asked to be good stewards, to feed the world's hungry, and to plant fence row to fence row, the church must raise questions about our economic structure and cheap food policy, which deprives farmers of a fair return. These are critical times for our rural communities as they try to be faithful to their calling as caretakers of the earth and stewards of God's gifts. The clear voice of the gospel and the caring support of the church must be part of that effort. Okay, so far my remarks this morning. Let me pass out this little booklet that was the result of hearings that the ALC had on land issues. I think we held a total of 7 hearings around the country to try to get input from various persons who were concerned about agricultural issues, and then to try to put those issues into some perspective, biblically and theologically. And you can take those along and read them at your leisure, but let's open it up now for any comments or concerns or questions.
What countries exemplify good stewardship of land? Where does the U.S. fit into that? Good crop rotation, build land, small family ownership. It seems to me like countries in England, or rather, farms in England, Scotland, are still.
Yeah, as I said, I don't want to be any expert, but that would seem reasonable to me. One of the things is, of course, we are still, I think, until very recently, we've had this sort of frontier mentality, which says, you know, you go and you use, and in a sense you exploit, even if you want to use that as a good or positive term, you exploit what's there and then you can move on because it's such a big country. That's been part of our history. You could always move farther out. Can't do that.
No, I was going to say can't do that.
I'd like to try to get at the root cause or the root solution of the problem. First of all, within the church, what percentage of the members of the church would consider themselves rural, farm-oriented, and what percent would consider them non-rural, otherwise related to, say, not as interested in the land, more in the food? For example, why did this group here, how many of us would be considered purely rural, farm-oriented? Do we have a show of hands?
Good question.
Rural with no farms.
Okay. I suspect that same ratio would be true throughout the church.
I can give you one quick statistic for the American Lutheran Church. The man who works most with the statistics for this recently said that 45% of the congregations of the ALC list farmers as a significant portion of their membership. That's one kind of thing.
So say significant might be 60%. Would be significant. So 60% of 45%, going 24% of the total. That comes to the problem. If you're non-farm oriented, how interested are you really in solving this problem that you presented this morning?
Yeah.
And it would seem to me that if it is truly a problem, and we all must accept that it is, downrange, it's going to be increasing and more severe, that we need as a church body to bring this 80% group around to truly understanding and willing to do something about it. For example, it comes down to a vote. How many of us right here would say, all right, I will contribute money, or I will agree to pay 25% more for my food right across the board in order to solve this problem. How concerned am I? And can the church do something to make me that way? Otherwise, nothing's going to happen.
The figures have probably changed a little bit, but I know a few years ago, Americans spent 16% of their dollar on food, which was at that time, I think, the lowest percentage of any country in the world. Okay. So that even though we worry about, you know, our high food costs, percentage-wise, we are probably eating cheaper than anybody else in the world.
That number is currently lower, too.
Is it? And
there's only 3% of the people in the United States who are farmers versus the 80%
please. Yeah.
And that's, you know, what you're saying, 3%.
Okay, so the point is, you cannot ever solve a problem unless you can get someone with you who wants to solve it. And there's no point of going to the government and say, you do something about it, unless you say, also, I want you to take a certain percentage of my tax dollars and establish a price or a use of farm board controls and operations to do something about this total overall thing. We complain a lot about the WAC and the conservation program. We complain a lot about all the things that we don't like what they're doing, without understanding that we are contributing to and supporting him and his attitude and the government's attitude toward conservation. And so how do we get into the act? That's the point. And can the church do anything about it?
How do we persuade people that conservation is in everyone's long-term self-interest? That's the question, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm not sure that they are willing to do something about it.
Yes.
With
yes.
their pocketbook or whatever else it takes.
Yeah.
And one other point. You mentioned, you know, contributing 25% more for your food. You could increase the income of the farmer 25% without raising the price of food. A noticeable amount.
There are probably a way. I'm not aware of
you know,
it.
Say a bit more about that, if you will.
There was enough wheat and a loaf of bread, but the farmer received approximately 4 cents. From a loaf of bread for the wheat that went into that bread. Today, I think it's a little higher than that, but not enough that it would make over a couple cents difference, and you notice that on sales anyway. You know, I think you could, you know, if you were to give the raise that 25% to a nickel or 5 1/4 cents for a loaf of bread, you would increase what the farmer received by 25%, but the consumer would hardly notice it at all.
Of course, you see, that's a distribution problem. The answer to that is obvious. Get together and let the farmer or the farmers as a group buy into the milling and the baking process so they can get a recovery. Since they can't get it off their land, we won't let them.
It is interesting. I don't remember the figures, but there are just several large milling outfits in this country that really buy all of the grain.
Yeah.
General Mills and a couple.
Jerry, there are five major grain companies in the world that control different percentages of different grain, but like 85% of the wheat, 80%.
So that's where your security would have to be.
Mm-hmm.
Not in raising the grain, but in being involved in the handling of it. That's where the money is. Since it's a money problem eventually.
Yeah, there are a lot of problems involved with that too. I think, you know, Ann Kenton and a group of people from Minnesota had Archer Daniels Midland had agreed to let them use their loading facility into this to make a direct sale, an export sale, directly from the farmer to the foreign consumer. But when they got on the other end, they could not find, one of the big five that would loan them their unloading facility. And it begins to cost you something in the neighborhood of $30,000 a day to keep that ship in port. And so even if you're unloading it by hand, you cut that margin of profit considerably if you have a few days
right.
delay. You know, and there are just all kinds of problems involved, and it's difficult to address.
You're a farmer, right?
No.
Okay.
I've done a lot of work with rural issues over Southwest Minnesota District.
Okay, good. What would you say are the kind of one or two or three central public policies that have been most detrimental to small farmers in your area?
The cheap food policy is obviously one. It's pretty tough.
But how do you spell that out for us? When you say cheap food policy, what constitutes a cheap food policy? Is it the matter of support program, the way the support program is devised to benefit large farmers? What pieces of it, I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but what pieces of it do you see as most critical?
Well, I think the price that farmers receive for their commodity certainly has a big part to do with it. You know, when Minnesota's champion grain farmer goes belly up, you can't say that he's a bad manager. We've singled that guy out and said, here is the best farmer we've got, and, he reaches the point where he's sold out. Well, kind of thing is not, it seems obvious to me anyway, that when you look at his overall operation, he was one of the better people in farming and did a better job of it than most of the other people that we have. And yet, because of his cash flow and the way it looked on paper, he was more or less forced out of business, as well as out of a way of life, I guess. So to me, the price that we receive for a commodity, it bothers me a lot, I guess, that we seem willing to stand by and give, a $1 billion to Chrysler, but we don't want to support, the farmers that has, a considerable amount of, that we have a considerable more dependence upon than we do upon a corporation like Chrysler. And really, most farmers don't want a subsidy. They just want a fair price for what they produce.
Isn't there a price support problem?
Pardon?
Isn't there a price support problem?
Yeah, I think there is. And yet, if we have a price support program that is below the cost of production, it becomes somewhat less than helpful.
I also think about the evils, the actual God-driven evils of the payment in kind program.
The PET program, cost us more and we got less for it than we did for
any
other.
I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about the land.
Well, I'm talking about every aspect of the economic structure in our country. I think that's also true of the farmer.
In other words, the people who created that program did not understand land.
They really didn't. No.
They thought they were doing a great good thing for the economy.
But it still
doesn't work.
You hear a lot of other statistics, and I'm a little uncomfortable with statistics, but President Reagan said that there are 4% of the farmers who are going out of business today. That's true. But the way the federal government defines a farm is any unit that sells $1,000 worth of gross agricultural products is defined as a farm. He said that's only twice the rate what it is in any normal year, 2%. The problem with that statistic is that, you can have 1 acre of pickles that you grow for Gedney and qualify as a farm under that definition. And some of those people went out of business because 95% of their income came from a non-farm source anyway. And so, they're choosing to leave the land, constituted a part of that 2%. And yet today, the people who are going out of business in that 4% are those who actually farm for a living and gain the major portion of their income from working the land. And when you look at it, when you convert that statistic, I think you'll find that, something 15% or higher would come closer to the reality of that situation in the countryside. And that bothers me a lot.
That's 4% of the land or 4% of the farmers?
4% of the farmers, right.
So then that
of the
probably,
farms.
We're probably talking about 4% is mostly at the small farms.
Or really non-farmers, in a sense. I mean, their livelihood is not farmers.
I'm saying the 4% though are farmers. Are people whose livelihood depends upon farming the ground today.
It's not just the part-time person, in other words, as in former years.
Right.
Who is dropping out because it really doesn't pay for him any longer to put in this stuff for $1,000.
It's people like.
It's now the person who really makes a living on.
Now, are you talking about now about concentration? In other words, that is indicative of the concentration is moving more to large farms. In other words, those 4% are not going out of production.
They are. They're being forced out of production because of that.
These are farmers going out of the business, not farms.
Well, their land is being taken over by their neighbors.
Their land is.
Consolidated.
Their land is contributing to Ed's number one point up there.
So you're talking concentration, that's what.
Yeah.
Now, I have to, let me ask a question that's, maybe I'll get in trouble for asking. It's a sensitive question, but it's one that I have to raise. I come from a farm. I mean, I grew up on a farm. But I am wondering to what extent farmers themselves have been lured into this process of concentration, this notion of bigger and better sort of thing, through the accumulation of bigger and bigger implements, for instance, machinery, and the expectation, and I'll even use the word greed, of somehow coming out with a huge bottom line.
Yeah,
there
you got it.
You got it right there.
Well, it's happened.
I mean, that's not the whole problem.
No,
I'm wondering if that there isn't a significant dimension.
I think that contributes to it partially, but I also think that farmers have been encouraged to move in that direction by the land grant universities and by the.
Who supports the land grant universities? Who supports the research that's done?
We do. You and I do. Through our tax dollars.
Who really though funds the research at land grant universities?
Government.
Yeah. No. And the corporations.
The corporations.
Yes.
The large corporations.
More like it.
And the large corporations have some self-interest, don't they?
Sure.
In promoting.
Weren't the land grant colleges founded by the government?
They were founded by the government.
No,
yes, that's right. But when the professor who is there, who has to earn tenure by producing a book or showing that he's done some significant research, he frequently gets his grant from the corporation who has this interest.
His grant by writing books, by maintaining his importance in the community.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Has there been any effort through federal funding to create incentives for conservation?
Hey,
yeah,
you can probably speak to
there
that.
There are some, yeah. And I think, you know, Ed talked about the windbreaks going out. They are going back in now, and I see that as a hopeful sign in the countryside. You see windbreaks pretty consistently traveling across southwest Minnesota. I guess I can't speak for any other area.
I noticed a number driving out here. And earlier in the spring, I was in Kansas, and again, there are windbreaks.
They are going back in, and that is a subsidized program to some extent, even though, you know, it does cost the farmer something also. But the question needs to be asked, you know, who benefits most from that? And the farmer does receive a benefit from it because it increases the value of his land. And so I think it needs to cost the people who farm the land something. But I think those of us who do not farm a specific parcel of land also have a stake in it, in that we're all dependent upon the land. You know, if you eat, you're involved in agriculture, you know, that's.
Well, is that part of the wind erosion program, with the windbreak?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also a form of conserving moisture.
Moisture, I see.
Yeah, it holds the snow on the land.
What is it done to protect the water table and the water erosion? What's happening at that level? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember during the Depression, there was a great push out in California where we were. The government came in and they offered and required all the farmers to put in cover crop in the orange groves and that sort of thing. Begs family, they said, get off my land, we do that anyway, you know, and they wouldn't accept this great help from the Democrats. This is the Republicans. And so, the point was that the government got into the act. And also, remember the Dust Bowl period in Oklahoma? At that point in time, the people were driven out of the state, and they all came to California, we thought. The result of that was that the government stepped in and developed this program in the rolling country where they tilled the land, contour tilled it, so that the moisture would stay in the soil and go in to replenish the water table. I understand now that the Great Basin table down through the central part of the country has been receding, being depleted. That probably is another conservation problem. And I don't know what is being done to handle that. That is obviously a general centrally funded problem.
And you have related problems of sort of the conflicts over land usage in, for instance, the upper Midwest parts of Montana, where you have coal that's mined, and then at least there have been proposals where they use water to drink.
Coal slurry.
Slurry
pipelines.
Well, in an area where water is very, very precious.
Well, I know in the coal mining areas in Wyoming, Montana, and even it started east, the cut and cover type of mining, where you cut off maybe 100 feet of top to get down to the lens of coal, that they now require that to be replaced and replanted to rebuild the original grasses. I don't know what happened to that.
I read one article that was kind of alarming on the water question that said that if we did build every coal slurry pipeline that is proposed in this country, that it would use all the fresh water annually that we use for every purpose times four.
Of course, they have a protection. The railroad is here losing a lot of business for the slurry pipeline, so they're not letting coal go across the right of way, so they're not coming back.
Yeah.
So we got a competition there.
Yeah.
That helps. John, you were going to
kind of a left-handed blessing, maybe.
Well, as the price of farm products is very well regulated by supply and demand, if we go from there, if we could increase the demand, the farmer would get more return. Now, what I wonder about is that in Brazil, 90% of the cars run on gasoil or alcohol. South Africa has the same story there. The oil companies apparently are trying to stop the use of alcohol as a fuel. There are examples of that, the Mobil Oil Corporation, who doesn't allow their dealers to market alcohol. Instead of paying outside countries, and I don't want to concentrate on the Arabs, you know, but I mean in general, why don't we try to promote, or the government to coerce the oil companies to start marketing a product which contains alcohol, which we could make out of grain? And whether it is ethical to turn grain into a fuel instead of into feeding the hungry is another point. But we could increase the production here and the demand here to an extent that we are less dependent on the outside world for energy.
Well, in Minnesota a few years ago.
You can feel comfortable in that approach because even though right now the alcohol blend of methanol, what do you call it? Alcohol and gas. That isn't economically viable right now. But as we go ahead and deplete our depletable oil resource, the fossil fuel base, and as that comes out of the ground, and that isn't replaceable. And so we keep drilling out of the ocean farther, but sooner or later, not in our lifetime hopefully, but we'll deplete that. But when we do, then the price of oil is going to go up so much that we're going to have to fall back on these reproducible forms of energy like the alcohol. So in time, it'll come. The time is not now, but it will be in time.
A few years ago, at least,
energy problem is another answer.
They were talking about the use of cattails in Minnesota, which grow profusely in the northern part of the state, and which are presumably good for anything else, but which are very good for producing gasoil. So we're going to cut down the cattails. Well, listen, our time is up. We have to call a stop now. Thanks again for coming.